Talk to Me, episode 8. On this episode, we talk to Max Illich of 40 Below Summer. They've got a great new album out called Transmission Infrared. I'm going to play a track from that album coming up pretty soon. It's been really great to see how the reaction to the podcast online. So far, most of the metal sites have picked up two of the blurbs from the podcast. Big shout out to Blabbermouth, the BRP, and all those sites for putting the podcast out there and kind of giving it some validity. This conversation with Max today is pretty freaking awesome. He goes into a lot of great stuff, a lot of behind the scenes in the music industry. It's just really good to catch up with him. Just want to say thanks to everyone that's been listening. Thanks to everyone that's been tweeting. Thanks to everyone that's been hitting me up on the Facebook. You can always hit me up at TalkToMeTalk on Twitter, facebook.com/TalkToMeTalk. So with that, I'm going to play you a song called Snake Charmer. It's off of Transmission Infrared, where you can get that on iTunes. You can get that on iTunes. You can get it on pretty much anywhere that you get your legally downloaded tunes. Here's some 40 Below Summer for you.
Turn away your work.
All right, that was great. That was Snake Charmer by 40 Below Summer. Here's the podcast with Max Illich.
All right, Max, welcome to Talk To Me. It's nice to have you on the line.
How you doing, brother?
Not too bad. Yourself?
No, not too bad.
Not too bad. All right, man. Well, let's get into this new album. Tell me about it.
It's called Transmission Infrared, and it's different. That's all I can really say. I mean, people always ask you to describe your next record, and, well, it's heavier, or it's this, or it's that, and that's not really how I can't describe it in terms of, like, style. I mean, yes, it's heavy. It's quite heavy.
Yeah.
Whether it's heavier than our last record or not, I guess depends on your perspective. But some people say that it's heavier. But it's just different. It's more progressive. There's a lot more interesting stuff going on. Different chord changes. Just, it's different.
Awesome. Yeah, I saw some pictures of the recent show you had. Tell me about that.
Which one?
seemed like it was maybe the Starland Ballroom.
I guess that would be our album release show, but it's like a pre-release because the official global release is Friday.
Yeah.
But this was like a way, you know, to give the hometown fans, a shot at buying the record, before, just a little bit in advance, I guess.
Nice. Are you guys planning like extensive touring on this, or are you gonna?
No, we're still doing it like we did last time, just weekends.
Yeah.
You know, we're all, you know, a little older now. We have jobs.
It's really
some of us have mortgages.
Right. It's really the only way you can do it these days.
One of us has a kid, you know, so it's like we do it on weekends.
Yeah.
And as far as we can get on a weekend, you know, we'll go play there. I mean, we're getting, you know, actually we're coming down to Tennessee. It's not confirmed yet, but we have the offer. We just have to find a date on the way back.
Nice. Yeah, you need to hit up your boys in Flaw.
See what they've got. Clarksville, Tennessee.
Oh, you playing the warehouse?
I'm not sure the name of the venue, but
yeah, it's a cool venue. It's not bad. It's kind of an army town, so you should do all right.
I don't know. We've never been there.
So. It's not in the middle of nowhere, I will tell you that, but it's a good club.
We've been to Memphis, and we've been to Murfreesboro.
Wow.
Yeah, and Murfreesboro wasn't a good experience. So.
I played many a show in Murfreesboro, so I totally know what you mean. If you're a hippie, band.
It wasn't the show.
Yeah.
It's what transpired afterwards.
Oh.
I'd rather not get into it.
You're going to deprive the podcast listeners of this wonderful story?
I got arrested.
Oh, no fun at all.
So, yeah, no fun. Again, it's a long story, but nonetheless, the bottom line is I got arrested.
Yeah.
Not on my record, but I had to pay several thousand dollars for it to not be on my record.
Wow. Yeah, the only time I actually went to like a house party when I was probably 17, 18. You know, Murfreesboro is a big college town, the middle
yes.
Tennessee state's there. And then there was this light in the corner of the room that kind of had a short in it. And every time you would kind of move, it would just go out. And then a guy showed up, and this is really the only time I've ever dealt with anything like this. But a guy, I don't know what happened or why, but he just started shooting. And that light got knocked out, and he just blindly was shooting in the dark. One of the more terrifying moments of my life. But,
I would imagine so.
You know, it's like the first time I'd ever really gone to like a college, frat party too. And I think that was probably the last time I ever went to one either. Obviously, I stuck out like a sore thumb anyway.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I've been to my fair share of frat parties, and
yeah,
I stuck out like a sore thumb too. But
sometimes
I guess,
that's a good thing.
I mean. I always ran in a lot of different circles, so, like, I mean, I always had, like, friends,
yeah.
You know, no matter what, to watch my back, I guess. But nonetheless, I mean, I got arrested with a joint, literally, that's it.
Tennessee,
and it cost me, like, almost $5,000.
Wow.
You know?
Oh, Lord.
It was a pain in the ass. A real pain in the ass.
Were you out on tour with somebody, or was that just who were you guys out with?
El Nino and Flaw.
Oh, there
this
you
was
go.
Back in 2004, I guess.
Yeah.
And I mean, like I said, I could get into more details, but then I have to start naming names. And,
yeah.
You know, nobody's going to get in trouble, but it's you know, I got, you know, this it could take up the whole podcast.
About the old podcast will be about that one time in spent in Murfreesboro.
Yeah, it's not worth it.
No, not at all. Just on that same token, I mean, what do you remember about those early tours with like Slipknot and Drowning Pool and those tours?
Well, the Slipknot, it wasn't really a tour. They did the Jägermeister tour with Fear Factory and Chimera.
Yeah.
And we, and this was on our second record, you know, so this was, around probably 04 also. Probably right before I got arrested. we opened, I believe it was 5 dates. And the way the tour worked was, it was those three bands. And then for every, like, region, they would pick a band that would open 5 dates. But oddly enough, we would have figured because we're from New York that we would have done the New York, New Jersey, the New York, Philly, DC, Boston, whatever dates that were like closest to us. But we didn't. We ended up doing all Midwest dates.
Huh.
Very strange. But it was great. Like I said, it was only about 5 dates. We did a lot of touring with El Nino.
Yeah.
On both records, first and second. And those were always great. I mean, you know, we came up with those guys from New Jersey. I mean, they're from the same neighborhood. We played a lot of local shows together before we got signed. So it was, you know, we both got signed like right around the same time. Our records came out a month apart. So it was, you know, it was, you figured it would be natural that we would end up touring together.
Right.
And Flaw, ironically, we met them while we were making our record in L.A. or in the studio next door to us. So when we ended up doing a couple of tours with them, too, it was just like, you know.
I was going to ask.
Their record came out like, you know, also like a week after ours.
Right.
You know, we toured with Chimera. We toured with, and their record came out like a week before, a week before ours, you know, so. You know, all these bands, you know, you knew you were going to tour with these guys. And we met the Chimera guys out in L.A. when we were making our first album.
Right, right.
So, well, at least we met a couple of the guys. I met the bass player, Jim, the original bass player. And I forgot which other guy I met, but I met them, you know, at the Rainbow Room in L.A. You meet everybody there.
Oh, yeah. I spent many a time at the Rainbow myself. Never got to see Lemmy, though. I never once got that
really?
Chance to see Lemmy.
Really? He was always there.
I right?
I mean, always. I mean, at least when we were there.
Lord, there were
certain people that were fixtures there that, I mean, if they're not touring or working on music at the time, they're at the Rainbow.
Right.
You know, well, back then, I mean, this is, we're talking 2001, so Lemmy was always there. Who else? Oh, Be Real from Cypress Hill and Steph Carpenter from the Deftones.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they had a group together called Kush.
Right.
I don't know if they ever put out any music because they were always smoking Kush. You know?
Right.
You know, right there on the little like patio on the Rainbow. They would sit there and just smoke weed all day.
Wow.
It was nuts.
That will hinder your making a record if you're doing a little
and Adam. And Adam Deuce, the bass player from Machine Head.
Oh, nice.
He was there all the time also.
Machine Head's such a great band.
Oh, yeah. Machine Head is the shit. But Adam was just, you know, such a nice guy. You know, just such a cool dude.
Yeah, yeah. He's definitely a cool guy. I met him many, many moons ago myself. But it's going to go into... So did you grow up around music? Did your parents play music around the house? Anything?
Yeah, my father was a musician, guitar player, studio and live guitar player for many, many famous people. Harry Belafonte, Gregory Hines, Aretha Franklin, Barry Manilow.
Oh, wow.
Ashford and Simpson. You know, It's a very long list.
So you're one of those kids that just kind of grew up with just random people at your house all the time?
Yeah, my mother was a singer-songwriter, and, you know, my parents wrote songs together and performed them and stuff. And, you know, it was just a musical household. You know, his father was a tour manager. His mother was a singer, you know, so.
Wow. You definitely come from a long line.
Same thing with Joey, my guitar player. His father was a session player. He played on a couple records with my dad, so.
Oh, wow.
Also a guitar player, so.
So your parent did?
Runs in both our families, so.
Do both of your sets of parents talk about that stuff, or are they still with us?
Well, my dad's still here. My mom passed away earlier this year.
Yeah.
And Joey's father passed away about maybe 2 or 3 years ago. But actually, no, 4 years ago. Oh. It's been a while now. You know, my dad will still talk about sessions and stuff. And, you know, I mean, he's in good health. He'll be with us for a while, you know, God willing. But my father's side of the family has the that longevity gene. They all live into their 90s. So nice. I'm pretty sure my dad's going to live into his 90s. He's still got a long way to go.
Very cool. Very cool.
But, music was always in the household. And
what'd you grow up listening to?
My parents split up when I was young, but.
Yeah, like all of our parents.
Yeah, they stayed, you know, civilized, you know, I guess somewhat civilized for my sake.
Yeah.
They stayed good friends, but they were never good as a couple because they were just like oil and water.
Oh yeah.
Personality wise, so they fought all the time.
Well, that's the only thing, you know, too. Like knowing my, as a kid, I didn't really understand it, but now seeing my parents now, I wonder how they ever got together in the first place.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's one of those. And actually, my aunt passed away a couple of years ago, and that was the first time that they had actually talked to one another in like 17 years. Like they hadn't sent a word, hadn't sent an email, hadn't sent a text, like never, had not said one word to each other, and it was pretty crazy. Pretty, you know, I got a picture with both of them. It was pretty hard time, but you know, it turned out to be a cool picture and good times. But you know,
hey, listen, you know, I one thing about my parents was I mean, even though they fought like banshees, you know, they always tried to stay friends, you know. If not for the sake of me, just, you know, for the sake of their own conscience, yeah. You know, because, you know, my dad realized that my mom did a lot for him.
Yeah.
You know, my mother was older, by a lot, but, you know, 6 years, 7 years. So, you know, she did a lot for him, you know, nurturing his talent, you know, and whatnot.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he was kind of young when they met, you know, like 23 or something, 24. And she, you know, turned him from just a talented guitar player and backup singer,
yeah.
You know, into this, you know, world-renowned session, you know, and sideman player for many famous people and, you know, many big records. He played on Roberta Flack's Feel Like Making Love, you know, which was a gold single.
Right.
In 1970, whatever, 76, I think. But, you know, my mother was also a difficult woman. So she's Jewish. So, anyone will tell you that's been married to a Jewish woman, they're all difficult. So, you know, it was a rocky relationship. And like I said, they were in so many ways polar opposites.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were, you know, they were good friends to each other, you know, later in life, even though they still fought like banshees. My mother just couldn't let my father breathe without, like, criticizing everything he does. The way he walks, the way he eats, you know, even to the, you know, to the day she died.
Oh, wow.
You know?
I couldn't even imagine.
And but you know, listen, he would tell her where to stick it. Don't think for a second that he didn't. But when the chips were down, you know, they were always there for one another.
Yeah. So what do they think about their son going into music?
Oh, they were supportive.
Yeah.
They were always supportive. You know, just, you know, don't be stupid. You know, once I got older, to, you know, it was like, go out there, you know, follow your dream, you know, your talents, this and that, but don't be stupid.
Right.
Meaning, you know, don't get fucked up on drugs. Don't, you know.
Don't get arrested in Murfreesboro.
Yeah, well, that was different. I had a joint.
Right.
You know, I'm sorry, weed is not a drug.
I don't smoke it myself, but I'm 100% for legalization and all that stuff. I think yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous.
It's not a drug, it's a freaking plant.
Right.
You know?
No, I agree with all that.
You know, so, I mean, they're talking about, my parents were hippie musicians, you know, like in the 60s and 70s. They smoked weed. But neither one of my parents, and listen, that was a time when people were trying and experimenting all sorts of shit, and they tried stuff, but they never really did anything else, you know, for any length of time except for pot, because they're like, the other shit is, you know, just not for us.
Right.
And that's true. I feel the same way. It's just not for me. The 90s, in a lot of ways, were similar to the late 60s. You know, that whole Lollapalooza movement. And
right.
All those pseudo, in a way, almost like hippie bands, like the Pearl Jams, the Soundgardens, the Black Sabbath. That music was trippy, you know.
Yeah.
As much as it was, you know, hard rock, it was also, you know, trippy and very 70s, late 60s and 70s influenced.
Oh, yeah, a lot of that early.
Smashing Pumpkins, yeah, Monster definitely. Magnet, you know, all those bands from that era. And, you know, yeah, I experimented myself, you know, in the 90s, but same thing. The other stuff is just not for me.
Not for you.
No.
So, right. So growing up in the house with all the music and stuff, what got you like, you know, what did you grow up listening to?
Well, I mean, I was, you know, born in the mid late 70s and I like mid 70s, 75. And I was, you know, like my musical taste, I started to acquire like, you know, I guess my own musical taste in the very early 80s. So, you know, I listened to, you know, I guess, you know, what you would have heard on, you know, MTV then, you know, the, like, the early Def Leppard stuff, you mm-hmm. know, like, High and Dry and Pyromania and, you know, as a kid growing up, like that stuff, Quiet Riot and, you know, I loved Thriller, Michael Jackson. You know, I love The Police. Still love The Police.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just, all, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, I mean, you know, all the 80s Britpop, too, you know, that I grew up to, you know, loving that shit. You know, some of the early U2 stuff was great. And that group Big Country, nobody remembers them. But, you know, actually, their big single was Big Country. You know, like I hear a lot of those old songs are like Wall of Voodoo, you know, like Mexican Radio. Mm-hmm. Like that was a, you know, another great one from back in the day, you know, the Eurythmics, all that stuff. And then into the, you know, more into the, you know, mid and late 80s, I started discovering, well, early 80s, I discovered like Van Halen too and Iron Maiden. And, you know, I loved those bands. But it wasn't until like the mid, like late 80s, like 86, 85, 86, 87, that I discovered Metallica.
Oh, right.
Megadeth, Anthrax, Slayer, SOD, MOD. And like, because, you know, I always loved hard rock and metal. I loved the sounds of a distorted guitar, you know. But it was when I heard, like, I can't remember what the first thrash song I heard was, but when I heard it, I was just like, what is this? The guitar sounds like a freight train, you know, because that palm muted chugging, they didn't do that in like regular metal. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I guess that's like back then, that's what you would call, you know, like Maiden and Judas Priest. I was never a big Judas Priest fan. But, you know, I respected them, you know, for what they did. But, you know, the operatic singing wasn't really like my cup of tea. So there were very few bands that would do that kind of singing that I was into. I mean, I loved Maiden, you know. And I loved Queensryche, but other than that, like most of that operatic type singing, I couldn't get into. But you know, once I heard thrash, it might have been Battery was probably the first Metallica song I heard, and probably one of the first thrash songs that I heard. But then I heard probably something off Testament's Legacy record,
yeah,
and that just completely changed me. You know, and then I heard, you know, Peace Sells. Well, I heard Wake Up Dead. That was the first Megadeth song that I heard. And that's it. I was sold on thrash music. I went on and bought all sorts of thrash records, you know, like from those bands to like, you know, Exodus and, you know, Overkill and, you know, like some of the darker stuff. You know, I said SOD and MOD, but, you know, like Nuclear Assault, which actually one of the guys from SOD was in Nuclear Assault.
Right.
And I ended up becoming, you know, kind of friendly with that guy, Dan Lilker, really nice dude. He was also, he ended up being in a band called Brutal Truth. And we ended up rehearsing like next door to each other when I first started 40 Below. And he was a real cool dude, just real cool dude. Big motherfucker though, like tall, like 6'5", 6'6". Real big. I was like, wow.
Giant.
I had met him before. I mean, I met all those guys, like, because my cousin was friends with Billy Milano. I met Billy Milano when I was like 11 years old or 12 years old or something. And I met all those, like, those hardcore dudes and like hardcore thrash dudes, like those crossover bands, like Evan Seinfeld. Like, he's another really cool dude. I like Evan Seinfeld a lot. One of our first tours 40 Below did, we did with Biohazard.
Nice. How was that tour?
Awesome, because Evan's fucking the shit, you know. He was just a crazy dude back then. I mean, I'm sure he's calmed down now. I mean, he's 7 or 8 years older than me, so he's he's got to be, you know, in his late 40s now. So, but who knows? I haven't seen Evan in a long time, but we had a lot of fun. It was such a strange tour. It was 40 Below, Biohazard, American Head Charge, and I forgot who the opener was on the tour, but very strange. But their fans were really good to us.
Were they?
Yeah, and they were good to Head Charge, too.
When I saw Biohazard, I saw him with, it was Ozzy, Danzig, Sepultura, Biohazard. And after Biohazard played, like, Evan came out and sat in the seats in the crowd and just watched, I think he watched Ozzy from the crowd.
He's like that. He's just, but it's weird though, like, because Biohazard's crowd was like, you know, even though, like, Biohazard got labeled, like, you know, more of a hardcore band or a crossover band, they were really the beginnings of rap metal.
Yeah.
Like, Biohazard to me was like one of the first actual rap metal bands.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know, it had elements of hardcore in it, and but their fan base was more of a hardcore fan base. So I would have figured, like, you know, that type of fan base, because we played with some hardcore bands, you know, that were more like straight hardcore, like, you know, old school. And their fans, you know, while they didn't boo us, they definitely didn't like us. Whereas with Biohazard's fan, they were fucking really cool.
Yeah.
But when we played with Anthrax, dude, people were throwing shit at us.
I had a band in Nashville that we were, you know, somewhat of a new metal band, and we got to open for the Michael Graves version of the Misfits. And it was just us and the Misfits. And
oh boy.
Let me tell you. It was pretty awful. That, like, we have video of that show. People are just standing there with their, you know, their arms crossed, just staring at us like, what is this nonsense?
Well, the thing is like, I would have thought that the hardcore fans would have been more fucking brutal to us. But no, dude, the old school, like, 80s thrash metal heads fucking hated any bands that were considered new metal. I saw Chimera, American Head Charge, and Slayer in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt so bad. I was at Roseland. It was fucking jammed, you know, sold out. There was 4,000 people in there. I felt so bad for American Head Charge because they were literally like the you suck, you suck, you suck from like the entire fucking crowd.
Wow.
And they were throwing shit at him, throwing ice, this and that. And Head Charge just went about playing their set, you know. Didn't say a word, did nothing. Now, when that shit happened to us with Anthrax at the Trocadero in Philadelphia, now the thing is though, American Head Charge, this was on their first record. Their album had been out maybe 3 or 4 months. They had played New York a couple times, but they did not have any kind of big fan base here.
Yeah.
They were opening up a show in front of 4,000 people, where even if they did bring 200 or 300 people, they would have been so overwhelmed by the other 30 3,800 people there that, you know, but at that point, Hedgehog wasn't bringing 200 or 300 people to New York. They were bringing maybe 20 people or 30 people. So out of the, you know, or 50 people, out of the 50 people there that maybe were Hedgehog fans, you know, they were outweighed by literally 4,000 people. So it is what it is. Now, when that shit happened to us, we were playing at the Trocadero with Anthrax, which is legitimately a smaller show, but there was still probably 1,000 people there. I would say probably maybe 40% of the, we were main support and there were two openers. I would say probably 40% of the club were fans of ours.
Yeah.
Relatively close, you know, it's an hour away from our normal Starland ballroom. Well, back then it was the Birch Hill. There was no Starland yet. You know, if we played in Philly, we were bringing 400 or 500 people back in 2003. This was easy, if not more, maybe 6 or 7, you know, because
yeah.
We, you know, we would do, you know, 1500 in New Jersey. And then in the neighboring cities, we would do about half that. You know, we'd go to New York, we do 700 or 800. We'd go to Philly, we do, you know, 600 or 700, something like that. So at a show where there's 1,000, 1,100, 1,200 people, probably half that crowd was our fans. The Anthrax fans hated us. They were throwing shit. We did not stand for this or tolerate it in any way. We threw it right back. We told them to suck our dicks. We told them we told them all sorts of shit. We called them pussies. We said, meet us in the fucking alleyway if you really feel that strongly about it. And we went out into the alleyway. And so did those kids, and not a single one of them took a single step forward. So, you know.
It reminds me of that. Have you seen that Bill Burr thing where he went off in Philly?
With who?
Bill, the comedian Bill Burr. Have you seen that by any chance?
No, I haven't. I usually don't watch a lot of stand-up comedy.
If you get a chance, if you get a chance, just look up Bill Burr in Philadelphia, because he basically, you know, he's a pretty huge comic, but he starts getting booed. Mm-hmm. And he rips them like such a new asshole. It's so amazing. And he's up there for like, he does a good 10 minutes of just like the dissing the Eagles, dissing the Phillies, dissing, you know, talking just every single thing like he can get onto. And it's classic. It's, you know, it's just so good.
Oh, fuck all you people. You know what, you fucking losers? I hope you all fucking die. And I hope the fucking Eagles never win the Super Bowl. Go fuck yourselves. And fuck the Flyers, fuck all of you, fucking goddamn fucking losers, booing Don Myrera, suck a dick, all of you, suck a fucking dick. How's that? No, I'm segueing into my next joke. You can all lick my fucking red nuts, all of you. You can line up in your Harold Carmichael fucking jerseys, and one at a time, you can all suck my dick. City of brotherly love, you bunch of fucking cocks.
Just walk around again.
Fucking goddamn losers. 52 fucking hours into a show. The fuck am I gonna do at this point? You people are on a goddamn acid. Fucking be up here talking about Hitler, that ain't gonna work. What do you want me to talk about? Hey, throw out some topics. Let's talk about heart disease. Something you're all gonna fucking die of, and I'm gonna laugh at your fucking funerals. It's gonna be great. Which is fantastic, because all your fucking heads are shaved anyways. No one's even going to notice. You're going to get fired for coming to work too late, because they're not going to notice that you have fucking bone marrow cancer. The only thing that's going to give it away is me laughing at you in the fucking background. You fucking bunch of losers with your fucking cell phone pictures. Fucking suck a dick. Fucking asshole. 11 more minutes of this. Your Ford Focuses, the fucking drive off the side of that faggot-ass Ben Franklin Bridge, you fucking one-bridge-having piece of shit city that no one gives a fuck about, the terrorists.
Well, I Yeah, I'll probably go check that out.
Yeah, it's definitely worth checking out.
I have to. When it goes bad for a comedian, then he attacks the crowd. That can only be a good thing for anybody who's watching.
Yeah.
Who's not actually in that crowd.
Right. No, it's so good. Yeah, just check it out, Bill Burr, and put it.
But nothing was as good as Michael Richards Kramer having his meltdown. Nah, that was just the best shit I've ever seen.
No, that was pretty bad too.
You know. What I know is the last 5 or 6 years, all of a sudden, all these prominent people are having fucking nigger meltdowns. And I can say that shit because I'm black. Right. Well, half black, anyway. My father's black. My mother, you know, she was Russian Jew. But, you know, all these people are, I can use both forms of the word, you know. So, you know, whether you want to, you know, say it either way, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, I know plenty of white people, you know, who are hoodish, who use the word plenty. So.
It's such a weird time with
and none of our black friends who, you know, who hang out with those people think anything of it.
Right. It's just one of those things too. I think, you know, with the cell phone, you know, cell phone camera culture that we live in.
It's just coming out of the woodwork now though. Yeah. But there are some people who just shouldn't say it because, right. You know, even if they, you know, like they hang out with that type of crowd. Like Hulk Hogan should never say it just because, and I love Hulk Hogan.
Right. Right?
You know what I'm saying? I never actually met the guy, but like, I was seriously thinking about back in like 07, like 06, 07, when that show was all over the place, mm-hmm. Hogan Knows Best. I was seriously thinking about contacting the guy. Cause I 6 degrees of separation. I'm only probably 1 to 2 degrees away from him.
Yeah.
You know, with the people that I know over the years. And I'm sure I could have gotten in contact with him if I wanted to, but the band I was in at the time, while the band was really, really, really good, I just knew it wasn't going to go anywhere because the personalities were just not going to click together. And that was Black Market Hero. But yeah. I wanted Hulk Hogan to be our manager.
Oh, man. All right, so you brought up Black Market Hero, and... So this is actually
I only brought it up just, you know, because it was part of the story. Like the band just died on the vine, but we had some great ideas and some really, really for the time, you know, for 2007, 2008, if we had come out with that record, like we were supposed to, it would have like, people would have been like, wow, this is really cool. This is different.
No, it was great. Like, you know, and this is where our paths crossed. I auditioned for Black Market Hero.
Really?
Yeah. And you'll know exactly who I am. Once I give you this story, but I lost my voice and I came up from Nashville and auditioned. And I had talked to a buddy of mine like the night before. Like,
did you audition on guitar or bass?
Bass. Yeah. We came up. I came up and I came up with a buddy of mine and I auditioned and like, I loved it. You know, those songs were great. I loved them. I had lost my voice the night before, so I got up there and I couldn't talk to anybody. I just like sat there. I couldn't say a word because I just had nothing. But yeah,
Shit.
So,
how did you? Did you just contact us through our?
Yeah, I was just through an email. I'm not even sure. I actually getting ready for the podcast. I was trying to remember how I even got a hold of you guys. I think it was just through, you know.
I think we had a Gmail.
Yeah, something like that, like blackmarkethero@gmail.com or something.
Something like that. Yeah. I met Micah ran all that stuff, our drummer.
Yeah, but, and that's who I talked to the most at that time.
Like, you know, he and I dealt with, like he and I ran most of the band, and Joey and I wrote most of the music, but mm-hmm. Micah and I did almost all the business and the engineering. Matt, I guess... our bass player we ended up getting in late 06. He did handle booking some shows, but you know, I guess he and I split the duties because yeah. I had the connections in the Midwest. He had some connections down south. So he would get us in like the Carolinas and stuff. Cause he lived there for a while. And then we went through, well, first our first guitar player was Ryan, but then we had Angel Vivaldi. I guess we were with Ryan for like 2 years and Angel for 2 years, and we still never put out a fucking record.
Yeah, I've still got those demos somewhere.
But the stuff, well, those demos were just like us kind of starting to write. It's the stuff that we did like end of 07 into like late 08. That was really cool. Like once we got Angel in the band.
Yeah.
Like he came up with some really cool shit. It's just that we had to, you know, it's like we couldn't take all of his ideas because, you know, then shit would start one way. So, you know, it was like I had, you know, like a 4 or 5 songs that I would write. Joey would have like 4 or 5 songs that he wrote. Angel had like 3 or 4 as he came a little later. But afterwards, we had like 12 or 13, like really, really, really fucking cool songs. It would have been a great record, but like nobody could really get along. You know, I mean, nobody like hated each other personally. It's just trying to agree on songs and direction and this and that was just going to be impossible with those that collection of guys. You know, so it ended up just dissolving. But look, it is what it is. I mean, we probably should have ended it a little sooner and just put 40 Below back together a little sooner, but.
Yeah, I was always bummed when I didn't get that. I mean, it was, to me at the time, it was, you know, when I first heard it, I was like, you know, kind of Killswitch Engage started kind of popping up and stuff like that. And like, you know, it just kind of fit right in with all that stuff. And I was like, man, this is going to be really good. And like, I still, you know, I'll come across that.
What we ended up doing was just a little different than that. It was more just straight thrashy because I was trying to push the guys, you know, away from like the metalcore bands because... You know, it's like that was everything was starting to flood, you know, because like Killswitch and then blew up in 05, 06.
Mm-hmm.
But by 07, 08, it was like it was them, all the remains, As I Lay Dying. There was a gazillion metalcore bands, you know, following them. Mm-hmm. You know, Parkway Drive came out, this band, that, you know, those bands have a little bit more of a death metal element to them, but it was still that same kind of sound and riffing and this. You know, and you know, on Earth, and you know, so I'm just saying it was just everywhere. So I was trying to do something a little different, you know. So I was trying to, you know, do something a little more just straight thrashy, you know, old school kind of thrashy, but with a different kind of vocal because I, you know, I sing a little differently.
Yeah.
I'm not going to sing like an old school thrash guy. It's just not my style.
No, it definitely worked. I mean, the songs themselves and, you know, the voice and everything. I was, you know, when I first got those demos, I was like, man, this is awesome. This is going to be something really good. But yeah, I got up there to do that audition. And like,
well, none of those songs were going to end up on the record.
Yeah.
We had all new songs. We had, you know, like from those first demos to what we were going to put on the record. We were supposed to do the record like mid-end of 2008.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be out in 09. Like, I mean, initially we would have that first demo initially with Ryan in the band. We were supposed to do a record of those first demos that you got.
Yeah.
And like, but there were like 5 or 6 more songs. We ended up scrapping the whole record.
Wow.
And writing a whole new record, you know, kind of with Angel, you know? So, and it's just like, it just seemed like there were a couple of guys in the band that just never didn't want to put out a record. They didn't say it. But if they wanted to put out a record, they would have recorded the songs. They would have recorded their parts. But they were always like, I'm not ready. I need to tweak this. I need to change this. I need to change that. And it never happened.
Do you think that was out of like a fear or was it out of just, you know?
I don't know, to be honest with you, because I got to a point where I just kind of like just threw my hands up and was like, whatever, you know, and started looking for other projects. For the last like 8 months that I was in that band to a year even, I was just kind of checked out. I was like, my parts are ready. I'm ready to record. Let's go. You know?
Yeah.
Whenever, you know? And Joey, of course, is the same way. Me and Joey are always on the same page.
And then, so after that, so I'm assuming that at around this time is when you, when 40 Below started doing shows together again?
No. Look, 40 Below has always just had a rough deal. We signed a nice deal. Before we even signed our deal, we blew a bigger deal. It's a long story, but like we essentially had an even bigger deal from Maverick than we got from London Sire.
Yeah.
You know, not much bigger, but bigger enough where it would have been like, oh, that's nice. You know, but the deal we got from London Sire was still big.
Well, how would you say you blew it? Like,
well, our managers at the time were No Name Management, who had Slipknot, Mudvayne, all those bands, you know, back then. But the guy who was running the company, he's dead now. He died of a brain tumor.
Yes.
God rest his soul. He was a crook. He was funny as shit, cool guy. He could literally swindle millions of dollars out of anyone like that has it. But, you know, he was crooked. So we signed with this dude, and he was also very full of himself. And we got this big offer from Maverick, and their old school way of doing things was the band knows nothing, we know everything, we'll let you know as you need to know. Because they didn't tell us about the series of advances we'd be getting, which included publishing and this and that, when we got our first offer from Maverick, which we should have just jumped on and taken, we said, get more money. You know, because we're going to need more money. That's not enough money. Like, upfront money, meaning, like, for the band. Yeah. The rest of the deal was fine. We wanted more upfront money. And if they had just said, oh, you're going to get double this in publishing, in a publishing advance, we would have been like, oh, then take the deal. But they didn't tell us this. And then their way of negotiating with Maverick was not answering their phone calls for a month.
Wow.
So Maverick pulled their offer. They were like, we're not going to be treated like this. We're fucking Maverick Records. So we ended up having to settle for a slightly smaller deal from London Sire, which was great. Still a great deal. We're happy we made the record. Invitation. We started touring, and shit started fucking falling apart immediately. We did a show in the city at the Limelight right before we were supposed to start touring at the end of June of 2001. Hector tore his ACL. We couldn't make that tour. Hector had to go for surgery. We had to find a replacement bass player, teach him all our songs, and then we had to leave in the middle of July on this very small tour with Factory 81, El Nino, and Chimera, but nobody's records were out except for Factory 81, and they had maybe sold like 20,000 records. Needless to say, the shows were empty. There was like 15 people, 20 people a night. It was terrible. We were wasting literally $5,000 a week in tour support on this. So was all the other bands, but, you know, I mean,
yeah.
You know, except for Factory 81. They were headlining, so I don't know why what they were thinking about headlining for.
That was the first time someone said Factory 81 in probably 10 years, so.
You know? You know, but I mean, I get it when you got nothing to do and there's no other tours. Yeah, fuck it, let's just go headline.
Yeah,
but they did like a whole freaking like 40 show U.S. headlining tour, like, and every show was empty, you know, except for like, you know, a couple of Midwest shows, a couple of Southern shows in everybody's hometowns.
Yeah,
but a lot of shows were empty. It was dead as summer. You know, I think Ozfest was going on at the same time. It's like, how many people do you expect to be at a show with three bands with no record out and one band that sold maybe, you know, 25,000-30,000 records, you know, in the mid of summer as Ozfest is going on, you know?
Oh, man.
Now, we still had fun.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but it was kind of rough, you know, in the sense of, this isn't what we were sold. But after that tour finished, we got some Mudvayne dates. Everything was great. The Mudvayne dates were awesome. There was 1,500 people every night, if not more. And we were killing it. We did, I think, 4 shows. And it was supposed to be like 11 or 12 shows. And then we were jumping on to like all these little mini runs, like a week with Stereo Mud, then a week with Drowning Pool, who was exploding at the time, then a week with Disturbed, who was huge by then. And after that, we didn't know, but they were, you know, our agent was going to fill in, you know, tours and dates for us. So everything seemed to be going all right. And then fucking 2 planes hit the Twin Towers, which is essentially our hometown.
Yeah.
We live, all live, we're New Jersey and New York City, but it was a whole clusterfuck. The label ended up folding. London Sire, they'd been a label for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
The label folded, which essentially meant all our funding was cut. But we couldn't go sign another deal because Warner Brothers owned London Sire, so Warner Brothers owned our contract.
Yeah.
They didn't even know who the fuck we were. For literally like a year, and they had to sift through, and they folded a lot of other labels too. They had to sift through probably a couple of thousand different acts that were on all these labels and say, keep them, dump them, keep them, dump them. And it wasn't like, you know, keep them, look at a piece of paper, record sales, dump them, look at a piece of paper. They actually would look at the band, listen to their songs. Isn't that so? It took forever.
Yeah.
We were like playing phone tag and talking to this guy and that guy for like a year before we finally just said, please let us go.
I think 9/11 like kind of almost killed, let's say 9/11 killed the new metal craze. I think it's so many, like I've had a couple other people on the podcast and like everyone.
I don't think so. I don't think so. No, I think just time killed the new metal craze because the new metal, nothing lasts more than a decade. Nothing does.
Yeah.
And new metal lasted a pretty long time, believe it or not. I mean, it started in the first new metal record, like real new metal record, was Korn.
Yeah.
That was the first new metal record. I mean, people can say, Rage Against the Machine, but no, that wasn't new metal. Rage Against the Machine was like bluesy rock with rapping over it, with a little bit of punk hardcore mixed in. It was nothing like Korn or Limp Bizkit or Seven Dust or Deftones or all those, you know, that wave of bands that came out, you know?
Yeah, I think when Korn came out, I mean, that was like the perfect storm of all the stuff that I was listening to before that came to being Korn.
Believe it or not, I also thought, even though that like they would probably, you know, Dimebag, God rest his soul, but like the other guys, Phil Anselmo especially, that Far Beyond Driven record to me kind of also like, because that came out, you know, also the same year that Korn's record, I think it came out a little before Korn's record. Yeah. I mean, Korn was doing their thing anyway, but like obviously all those bands, Deftones, Korn, were very influenced by Pantera.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Phil Anselmo, like, you know, he was one of the first guys that started screaming like that, you know, that new metal scream, you know, kind of came from Phil Anselmo and Mike Patton, you know, nobody else screamed like that. Those are the two guys that from almost day one screamed like that scream that, even Jonathan Davis never screamed like that. The first other guy to scream like that was Chino.
Yeah.
You know, cause first you had, you know, Patton and Anselmo and they did it in their own, differently in their own ways, but it was still kind of that scream, you know, whereas all the other thrash bands and hardcore bands, they would do like yelling or this and that. None of them would scream like that, where it was that ripping, you know, that scream, you know? And then Chino was the next one. And then after that, every new metal band did it.
Every single one.
And then every metalcore band did it. And everyone does it now.
I think my point on the 9/11 point was more everyone that I know that had albums out of that time kind of pinpointed that to where everything just kind of stopped, you know, and only if, you know, I was in Primer 55 right after that. And, you know, the new release had come out and, you know, basically the same thing happened to them. They were selling, you know, 5,000 copies a week, doing good tours, and then 9/11 hits, and, you know, they basically are told to go home and write a new record and just sit and wait. And, you know, it was
When were you in Primer 55?
I came after Kobe and Primer.
Oh, okay, because we toured with them was it right after 9/11?
I joined like the next year, like mid next year, 2002.
Yeah, because we toured with them. Had to have been like early October.
Yeah.
Like late September, early October of 2001.
Yeah, so I mean,
and I like those guys. Like, I mean, Kobe was a, you know, sweet guy, and I like Bobby too. He was a nice guy.
Yeah.
But Kobe almost actually joined Black Market Hero.
Yeah, it was funny when I actually, that was another thing
and 40 Below, like, but for different things. We were trying to expand. He was gonna do keyboards and percussion and backup vocals. He's a really talented dude.
Yeah, never actually met him. I met him one time, but I've never actually like talked to him for a long extended period.
Well, the thing about Kobe was, and I mean, I don't know if it was, you know, just because he didn't maybe like want to be a side man in a project, because he's kind of, you know, does his own sing, songwriting, playing guitar, lead vocals, and he has his own studio, and he's a very talented guy.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe being like kind of a side guy in a band wasn't, but I mean, he played bass for Primer 55, so I wouldn't want to do, you know, be an all-purpose guy who did vocals and not, you know, I said to him, I'll give you leads, you know, mm-hmm. like in parts. I don't, my ego's not so big that I can't, you know, like give you even a whole song and leads in songs and I'll back you up, you know, I could use the break.
Yeah, definitely. No, but yeah,
he was just a little flaky. Us. I don't know why.
Yeah, when I first contacted you guys to audition, they're like, "What's up with former Primer 55 bass players?" You know, because I think.
Oh, that's awesome. Right. Now I remember that. Yeah. Because Kobe had come down to play bass for Black Market Hero.
Yeah.
Or he was supposed to, but he didn't. Like, he flaked out.
Huh.
You know, because we wanted a bass player who could do vocals.
Yeah.
You know. Because we always had two backup singers in every band that I've been in. With Black Market Hero in the very beginning, because Ryan from Flaw, who played guitar for us, I mean, he was the bass player for Flaw, but he played guitar for us. He was originally a guitar player, and he's good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Another very talented guy. He could sing, you know, he had a good, strong backup voice. So we definitely wanted to get a bass player who could sing, because Joey can sing, and he's actually doing some melodic backup vocals now. But he just never did them back then. He would only do screaming.
Yeah.
But ironically, he's doing like, there's about two or three different songs now where he's doing some melodic vocals and he does them fine. You know, he does them actually pretty well. But we also have Dave Mondragon now playing guitar for us because Jordan, you know, got married and he decided he just couldn't make the commute. The commute was probably, I would say, like 80% of the reason why he left the band. But we have Dave Mondragon now, who is but he's the best backup vocalist I've ever had in a band. And Dave, you might know him from a band called E-Town Concrete. So
I remember that band, yeah.
Yeah, well, if you ever go back and listen to them, like, you know, I know a lot of people with the rapping and the this and that, whatever, but go listen to the band. They were really good. You know? I mean, Anthony was good, too, when he ended up deciding to sing. He could sing.
Yeah.
You know? But I always give them credit, you know, even with the rapping, too, because the rapping that they did was different. He was very... you know what I'm saying? When the new metal, especially the rap side of new metal happened... All the rappers were like whiny white boys sounding, like they all sounded like a cross between like Zach De La Rocha and Ad Rock from the Beastie Boys.
Right.
You know, like that kind of whiny sound. See, that's Ad Rock. He made that shit. He made that shit. You know, I actually kind of grew up with him too. He's a little older than me also, but his ex-wife was like my cousin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like her mother and my mother were best friends. So like, I knew that guy since I'm like 12 years old. I've known a lot of people through my parents too, you know, for a lot of years, but it's like, that was that new metal kind of thing. Whereas with E-Town, if you go back and listen to him, he didn't sound like that. He was deep. His voice was deep. It was rough. It was thuggish,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, he grew up in a bad neighborhood, you know, I mean, Elizabeth, New Jersey is not, you know, a nice place to grow up. That whole area, Newark, Linden, Elizabeth, is not a nice neighborhood.
Oh, man. Haven't been
back. You know, but all these, but the funny thing is about E-Town Concrete, all those guys were like honor students. All of them. Honor students, clean living guys, like, you know. But none of them were, aside from Anthony, were really into hip-hop. They were all like metal and hardcore guys. You know, so E-Town, you know, doesn't really play that much anymore. Just like once a year, they'll play, you know, the hometown show at Starland Ballroom and, you know, maybe an occasional show here or there. So Dave was free, you know, so we brought him down. So, and our drummer, our new drummer, who's a machine, he's a beast. If you've heard our new record yet or any of it, like, he's a beast. That's all him. We don't edit. We don't, you know, do do that chopped and sliced and diced and
right.
all that stuff. You know, we'll clean up a couple of things here and there on the drums only because he's doing so much, you know, rapid fire, double bass. You know, if there's a hit that's a little funky, we'll, rather than make him do, you know, 15 takes of it, you know, he'll get through three or four takes. We'll pick the best one. And if we have to move a kick drum hit in a rapid fire double bass spot or some crazy fill that he does, let's just nudge that thing right there. You know, that's it. That's all we do. Other than that, we don't touch anything else. And then we record the guitars like live with, you know, a couple punch-ins here and there. No editing. Vocals, same thing. Live, couple punch-ins right there. No editing.
I think double a lot of that music will come back around to that too.
Double it, triple it, you know.
Then so much new, so
flip
much
the
new
board
music.
Over for a mix and mix and, you know, mix it old school, you know.
Yeah, just so much new music is just so computerized and, you know.
Yeah.
You know, there were times back in the day, like Fear Factory, you kind of wondered if it was real drums or not, but like, because they were just so good and like so machine-like. But then now.
No, they weren't. No, well, no, that guy plays that good.
Well, yeah.
But like, he's, but the drums back then, I mean, I think they used like triggers inside a real drum set.
Yeah.
And just recorded the triggers.
To where now, pretty much, you know, it seems like almost every drummer is, you know, it's either A, triggers, or B, not even a drummer. It's just a, you know, program. So,
well, I don't know about the program stuff, but yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, I know people do program stuff like a lot of solo artists, you know, yeah. like guitar people, like, and stuff like that, you know, we'll just program the drums and this and that, and, you know, then record the guitars and bass themselves, you know?
Right.
And if there's no vocals, but like, I mean, I know even like, you know, great musician bands like Periphery, like those guys like are all sick musicians.
Oh yeah.
All those drums are triggers. There's not a single real drum tone on any of their records. You know, what they'll do is the guy will track the drums. He plays all that stuff, but then they just replace the sounds
right.
with, you know, with triggers.
Yeah.
And, you know, with triggered sounds, you know, so they don't have to bother trying to tune a drum set, get good mic placement, get a good tone. You know, it's too much work.
Yes.
You know, but what happens is that takes away the uniqueness of the sound of the album.
Yeah.
You know,
that's what I've had a couple other people on the podcast and, you know, like Fred Corey from Cinderella was on the podcast and he was talking about how he loves the new music that's coming out, but it just all sounds the same because everyone's using the same programs and everyone's using
exactly.
the same,
everyone's using the same triggers. Everyone's using the same guitar simulators now. Nobody even uses amps anymore.
Yeah.
And it's just, to me, it's just, it all, like, the tones all sound the same. So it's hard to differentiate what you're listening to.
It really is.
You know?
So
No, I was saying, whereas the records of old, they sounded unique because that session was different, you know, it was a different room, different microphones, different board, different preamps, different equalizers, different speakers, different, you know, amps, different mm-hmm. guitars, different, you know, so it was different.
Yeah, now you can plug pretty much any guitar into a pod or whatever, you know, whatever's going on these days and, you know, and get whatever tone you want, no matter what you're playing. It's
well, no, the pods are things in the past. No,
yeah.
Like even the fractal, the Axe Effects, that's what everybody's been using lately.
Yeah.
Like even those are like now being surpassed by these new, they're not amp modelers or even simulators. They're what they are is they're like, they're amp recorders.
Yeah.
It's like they can, you know, if like you put a microphone in front of a amplifier with its cabinet, this thing will record it, and then you kind of have that amplifier in there, but it doesn't sound 100% the same.
Right.
Yeah. It sounds very, very close. But when you start to crank it, because it's still digital,
yeah.
that's where it doesn't have the oomph that a tube amplifier does. When you start to push it, or when you try to record with it, even, it's just not the same. Tubes do something. Tape does something. Analog does something to the sound that digital still can't quite reproduce. It's getting closer.
Yeah.
Or it can, I guess, reproduce the processing power you need would still be so expensive. You need like a $50,000 computer.
No, it's not, you know, you almost can't even be like just a good old record player either, so.
Well, no, analog, you know, has a higher frequency range than the digital that we listen to.
Yeah.
You know, and yes, people say the human hearing only goes from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, but that's not really true. The human ear and the human body can hear and feel transients well below 20 hertz and well above 20 kilohertz. You know, hence why there are, you know, all the digital recording mediums, Pro Tools, this and that, record at high resolution. They don't record at the same bit rate as CDs or MP3s. They record at high resolution. You know, CDs record 16 bits of information at 44.1 kilohertz.
Right.
We record records at 24 bits. And usually 96K or 48K or 96K, you know, kilohertz,
yeah.
Which is a higher resolution. It's still not close to analog. Analog peaks out at like 110 kilohertz. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And that's the frequency it hits. Believe it or not, 96 kilohertz will only peak out. It'll peak out at half, 48 kilohertz. So to really come close to analog recording, you would need to probably record at 192 kilohertz or above. It's a lot of processing power.
Yeah.
To do 64, 96, you know, whatever, how many tracks these bands do, use so many tracks today now. Also, they don't like, I mean, my buddy Dan is Dan Cornef. He's the engineer who did Morning After. He's done a lot of major records now over the years. And, you know, I see him doing stuff. Hey, come here. I'm walking my dog right now.
Oh, okay, cool. I knew something was going on. Couldn't tell what it was.
But he's recorded a lot of records over the years. And he's posted something on Facebook the other day where he posted something on Facebook where he had tried, was it like 116 tracks? And this was like a metal band.
Yeah.
116 tracks?
Of what?
For a song? Like, what? How many? How is it possible to use 116 tracks?
It's crazy.
You know, if you're like a metal band. I find this completely hard to believe and absurd. 116 tracks.
That's crazy.
Like, I don't think we've ever used more than 48. I don't really know. I don't think so.
No,
we might have.
Yeah, but
when we did our main, you know, invitation or Morning After, we might have. But I doubt it. And if we did, maybe it was like, you know, in the low mid 50s. And that's because, you know, we have all our drum tracks and then the samples on all the drums, you know, so. Because Invitation and Morning After, yeah, those were all samples.
Yeah.
There were little to no real drums on that, right, on those records, which I didn't like at all.
Oh yeah, it's like the first Primer albums, pretty much a drum machine too.
But, no, it's not a drum machine. It's our drummer.
You know what I'm saying.
But the guy who mixed the record, Toby Wright, he replaced all the drum sounds with his own samples.
Huh.
You know, he didn't edit anything. He just We actually, on Invitation, we didn't really edit the drums at all. It was pretty simple, you know, a lot of the drum stuff that he was doing. I mean, there was some pretty intricate stuff and some you know, like crazy fills and stuff. But, like, you know, Carlos was a very good drummer.
Oh, yeah.
But he just, by the second record, he had lost his passion.
And that's the sad part with most musicians too, when they do lose that passion and lose that the inspiration that got them there.
Not inspiration. I guess he was inspired to do other things, but he lost his fire. That's what I'm saying. He lost his fire to go out there and kick ass.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, we probably should have parted ways sooner. We parted ways twice, but we should have parted ways the first time sooner. and, you know, just moved on with a different drummer. Because, you know, if your heart's not in it, you know, and it's not touring or this, if your heart's not in playing that type of music, then, you know.
Yeah.
I think he didn't know what he wanted to do back then. So, you know, it is what it is. We all make mistakes, but I guess that's why it leads you to where it leads you. But, like I said, we always had it rough. So, you know, and the second after that, that just takes kind of the wind out of your sails. But then the second record, you know, we had trouble with Razor and Ty. They really had no experience at the time putting out, you know, rock albums. They were known for like kids pop.
Yeah.
Shit like that. Like, and Rasta jams and love ballads. Like that was all Razor and Ty.
Yeah.
Their foray, they put out, I think Brand New was one of their bands. They put out that record. Then they put out the E-Town Concrete Renaissance record. Then they put out The Morning After. And they really dropped the ball with all three records because they just didn't know what they were doing. They had no clue. They had one guy on the whole staff that knew what he was doing, and he quit 2 months after our record came out. So, yeah, that shit was doomed. But we ended up actually getting the rights to Morning After back, and we got a little money out of the deal on the back end. They had to pay us to kind of go away.
That's always
which is kind of rare in the music industry. So, but in retrospect, we probably should have, because we had it under contract that they had to pick up our next option. We should have just taken the option.
Yeah.
And made them spend the money, you know, and put out a third record. It might have been, you know, of fighting a losing battle, but we would have still gotten another, like, you know, couple hundred grand out of the deal.
Right.
Not for our pockets, but like we would have gotten another, you know, 15 grand a piece, and then had another, you know, $150,000 to $200,000 to like market and tour the record. We had to spend it. It was in our contract. If we said we want to stay and do it, we should have just done that. But we were so disenchanted with them.
Oh, unfortunately, this business is a whole lot of.
And we thought we could get another deal, but
yeah,
that's when, you know, like, we started having problems like with Carlos again. So we ended up parting ways with him, and then trying to find a drummer was a nightmare. And, you know, Jordan was gone now too for a spell. And then we decided, let's just start something new. And that's how Black Market Hero was born, you know, and Ryan had just moved to the city.
Yeah.
You know, from Flaw, because he was at the time he was dating Mistress Julia.
Yep.
That's how that happened. But what we probably should have done is when Black Market Hero ended, we should have put 40 Below back together, but we didn't. We Joey and I tried playing with a band called With Daggers Drawn. There were some local guys from here who had a lot of talent, but were unfocused. Joey and I tried to focus them. It didn't work. And we wasted another 2 years. So.
Well, I think the musical climate right now, you know, bringing the band back around right now is actually probably a perfect time for 40 Below to come.
No, it really isn't. It's like the worst time. People spending the least amount of money.
Yeah.
People care the least. It was a little too long of a hiatus. You know, we should have really come back around like 2009, like done a show, made a record, put it out in like 2010, 2011. You know, built some momentum into another record, which would have been Fire at Zero Gravity in 2013.
Yeah.
Into now, which we would have had a lot more momentum going into now. And we wouldn't have lost as much of the momentum that we had lost, you know, when we took our hiatus in 2006. You know, you could take 3 years off.
Yeah.
Taking 6-7 years off, you know, it's cool if you're Metallica.
Yeah.
It's cool if you're Tool. It's cool if you're even, you know, the Deftones. You know, or I mean Slipknot too. You know, I mean, they take about 4 or 5 years in between albums. So, you know, I mean, if you're big like that, sure.
Right, right.
You know, or even if you're like Cold Chamber big, like, I mean, they're working on a new record, but when they did that reunion tour last year, it was, you know, it did really well. And even this past tour that they did really well. But when you're, you know, but Cold Chamber has a gold record.
Right.
You know, and another record that sold like you know, 350,000, and even their last record sold like 250.
Right.
You know, when you're a band like that, yeah, you can go, you know, even take, you know, whatever they took off, you know, 10 years. But
well, you know, and, plus, with he, you know, he was also doing the other stuff too.
Well, yeah, and he was still in the limelight, right. You know, like doing, you know, a Double Driver.
Right.
So, but you know, when you're a band like 40 Below, who, you know, only had two major records, and the first one's probably sold now about 90,000 maybe in the United States. And the second one, well, it can't go higher than whatever it was, 60,000, because if it did, Razor and Ty had to pay us this big bonus, like a $50,000 bonus. So they stopped shipping the record at like basically at 60,000.
Right.
So, but look, it is what it is. You know, I mean, it's a rough business, but like we just a combination of bad decisions and bad luck, you know, ended us. But you know, no matter what, we still had a lot of fun because, you know, after all the nonsense that we went through, you know, Invitation and Morning After both were very heavily downloaded records.
Yeah.
Not unfortunately, you know, not paid downloads. They were, you know, ripped off the internet.
Yeah.
So we had a much bigger fan base than our record sales would indicate. So when we would do like headlining runs, you know, even though we, you know, like I was talking about Factory 81, maybe selling 30,000 units. Maybe when we did our first headlining run, we maybe only sold 50. But instead of there being, you know, 30 people a show, 40 people a show, 20 people a show sometimes, our shows were like 250, 300,
yeah,
350. In some markets, 450. And even a couple of markets like Columbus, Ohio, we would do like 600 to 700 people. And of course, in New York, New Jersey, Philly, like we would do those kind of numbers. And in New Jersey, even more. So, you know, but Boston too, we could, if it was a weekend, we could do 600 people in Boston. Oh, not now, but back then. You know, as a band that sold 60,000 units at the time, you know, when we did our second headlining tour, you know, our average draw for the whole tour was like 400 a show. And it was like a 25 show tour. You know, 25, like, for the most part, major markets. You know, Norfolk, Virginia, you know, New York City, you know, North Jersey, North Central Jersey, Philly, Allentown, Boston, Hartford, Connecticut, St. Louis, Columbus, Cleveland, Detroit, like all those places. We play like 400 to 500 seaters, packed. Packed. Right. You know, so we built up a really nice fan base. And, you know, given the fact that, for example, like, yeah, the show that we just did at Starland Ballroom was a little smaller than usual because we had to go, ended up going against the Rock Allegiance, which was like Korn, Godsmack, Five Finger Death Punch. And it was, you know, like less than an hour away. So obviously that took a lot of our normal draw away, but we still had close to 800 people.
Wow.
At our show. And this is 16, 17 years after we started.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, and the last time we did a headline to Starland Ballroom show, it was us and God Forbid, and we did, you know, almost 1,400 people.
Nice.
You know, we headlined God Forbid was main support, and then there was like three or four locals.
Well, that's awesome, Max. Well, hey, we've went over our hour.
Somewhere. Oh, wow.
Right, yeah, I looked at the time. I was like, yeah, we've been talking. But I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up with a couple questions. On the new album, and this is probably going to be the million-dollar question, so sorry if you've heard this one before, but you do the Justin Timberlake cover. Where did that come from?
I just, you know, thought it was a really cool song.
Yeah.
And I suggested it to the guys. I'd kind of like to cover this. I think we could do a really good job with it. And I have this idea of how to do it. You know, like an arrangement. And the guys were like, okay, it could be cool. It's a dark melody, haunting melody. You know, something you could work with very minor keys. This is right up our alley. So I have a drum machine and this. I mean, I can play drums a little bit, but not, you know.
Yeah.
But I play guitar. I can, you know, I write a lot of our riffs. So I just said, give me a couple of days, you know, a weekend with it, you know, and I'll get the arrangement out. So I programmed some drums, and then I played some guitar and bass and laid down the vocals. And it's essentially almost exactly the same as the version I laid down with the drum machine. It's just got a little bit more of a jazzy live feel because there's a real drummer playing it.
Yeah. But,
you know, nobody really changed the parts that I had, you know. Dave came in and tweaked, you know, a couple of the lead guitar parts a little bit. But other than that, it's pretty much the same version that I had. And it just, it came out really cool. I mean, I don't know if you've heard it yet, but.
Yeah, I checked it out a little while ago. But I was like, it's a very, very cool version of it.
Where, did you hear it live or did you hear the.
There's I think the album's on YouTube.
The album's already on YouTube?
Yep.
Fucking douches.
Right?
Yeah. We started selling the record Saturday night.
Yeah.
Power the internet. On YouTube.
Yeah. I think whoever put it up, at least they were kind enough to, I think in the description it says available on iTunes Friday or something, you know, like available on iTunes with a date. So, you know, at least they're not too douchey to do that, but
and people can figure out ways to rip it, but you know, I mean, when you upload that shit on YouTube, it sounds shitty anyway. You're gonna want to buy, you know,
at least get
the iTunes version anyway. But nonetheless,
that was actually like, the second question was just, you know, how can people find the record? Obviously,
iTunes. I mean, iTunes, Amazon, have digital versions of the record, all the main major places, because we're distributed digitally through E1.
Okay.
So all the places that you would go to find a record digitally, you know, I'm not going to name all the names because it's silly and redundant. Right. Anywhere you would go and digitally download a record, you know, where you would go pay, you know, iTunes, Amazon, whatever. And if you want physical CDs, either come to a show or we're going to set up a web store sometime in the next week or two. And, you know, you can send us orders and we'll mail it out to you. You may have to wait a week or two, you know, depending on what we're doing, where we are, if we're playing shows, this, that, blah, 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 you know. But you'll get your record. And other than that, that's it. The album's Transmission Infrared. It comes out worldwide this Friday. October 16th, which is ironically the 14-year anniversary of the release of Invitation to the Dance, October 16th, 2001. So we're keeping with a little theme here. Other than that, I just want to say, you know, we're 40 Below Summer. We do what we do. We always try to make different and unique sounding music that appeals to our ears, and we hope that it appeals to yours. We also have a record from 2 years ago called Fire at Zero Gravity, which is also available on iTunes. For the real diehard fans of the band out there, that's the way you should go, you know, grab it from there, get up quick, no mess, just click credit card, boom, now you have the album. And all the money goes to the band, with the exception of like maybe 25% goes to E1 for digital distribution, and iTunes takes like 40 cents or something. So we actually make like over $7 for every $10 that you spend on an album of ours. So, you know, if you really want to support the band, that's the best way to do it.
Oh, that's awesome, and I hope everyone goes to do that. Well, Max, I appreciate you taking the time.
And it's my pleasure. You know?
And when you come through town, we'll definitely have to hook up. And
yeah, like I said, it's looking like it's going to be February 19th, which is a Friday.
Yeah.
In Clarksville.
Clarksville's Tennessee. About 45 minutes outside Nashville, but that's a cool club, and you know you'll definitely have a crowd there.
Well, I hope so, because we haven't been to Tennessee in 11 years. And the last time we were there, it was Murfreesboro, and I got arrested. So, I'm hoping for a better time this time around. So,
All right.
But man, it'll be fun. It'll be fun, no matter what. We always make a good time of it.
Cool. All right, man, we'll take it easy, and be safe out there, and don't get arrested.
All right, thank you, brother.
And there you have it, guys, my conversation with Max Illige. It was great to catch up with him. It was great to for him to go into so much detail about 40 Below Summer. Go and check them out wherever you can, whenever you can. Great live band. Great guys. Great. Got a couple of great interviews coming up. Next Tuesday on Talk To Me will be Alexis from Straight Line Stitch. Great to catch up with her. Haven't talked to her in a long time. Got some other great stuff in the works. So this week I'm going to leave you with The Fuck Off and Dies with Drink, Drank, Drunk off of their new album, Dear Liver. You can get it on iTunes. And like I said, get it wherever you can legally download your tunes. So until next Tuesday, this is The Fuck Off and Dies. Have a good week, everyone.
Drunk to think somebody pass me a fucking drink. Now I don't give a fuck.